Well, aloha, everybody. This is your spiritual warrior goddess, Kathy Bilski, with the Quantum Leap Let Light Unite show on UPRN. And this is April 8th, 2016. Hope you had a really great week. And I know you didn't hear me last week. Station had some glitches. And, you know, I wouldn't really think much about it, you know, because things happen and things go down and you don't get on air. But my guest last week was a Native American Indian, Blue Thunder, and he's going to be on next week, by the way. And, you know, not only did the station go down, but 10 minutes before we were supposed to go on air, somebody got into his Mac computer and hacked it so he couldn't use his computer, and he could not call out over the phone. Now, for you censors, you know, I think that's really overdoing it, right? I mean, that's a little over the top and overkill, because if you take the station out, you don't need to do anything else, right? Okay, come on. Use your brains. Okay. Anyway, so I've got a special guest for you tonight, and he's a reoccurring guest I really love talking to, and this is Elliot Adams. He's gone from real quick to the warrior and to a nonviolent warrior and works for peace. And, gosh, he's all out there all over the place. And you are, Elliot. You really are. So, Elliot, welcome to the show.
Well, it's wonderful to be back on the show with you. I really appreciate what you do for us all by getting important information out to people, which our regular media refuses to do.
Well, let's get right to it. We were talking about, right before we got on air, about what you were doing recently, and you were talking about the pipeline. Do you want to expand on that?
Certainly. Of course, here in New York, we've had a big struggle over, first they were wanted to hydrofrack, and amazingly, we have gotten the governor to basically ban hydrofracking in New York State for the time being. Obviously, none of these things are forever. But that has been an amazing struggle and finally successful. But now we are dealing with a couple of things. They all have to do with the gas infrastructure. So we have three pipelines they're trying to put through our area to carry the natural gas out for export, and we also have a major gas storage facility they're proposing. Now, not very long ago, I was down there in L.A. at the big gas lake they had down there. I don't know if you recall
that's Porter Ranch, right?
That's the Porter Ranch. That's correct.
And it's still going on, isn't it?
No, they sealed it. They sealed it about 2 days after I was there, 3 days after I was there, where they said they did. But that leak, which was storing, it wasn't the hole into the natural reserves. It was gas that they pumped down. Do I have you?
Hello? 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 We lost Elliot.
Hello.
Okay, Elliot, you were back.
And I was saying
Is he gone again?
Every hour that leak was going, it increased the greenhouse footprint of California by 20%. And obviously, we don't need one of those storage areas here. But they are they're planning to. Did I tell you about this before?
Well, no.
Yeah. So anyway, they had the plan here in New York is we have these salt solution mines where they've dissolved the salt with hot water and pumped it up and then now they want to store gas in there.
Can I ask you something? Really, isn't this kind of like the Louisiana sinkhole that's down there that was built over a salt mine, you know, or in a salt mine? I mean, aren't we kind of talking about possibly the same thing happening here?
We certainly seem to be, and nobody's ever been able to look into this mine because it was all done by pumping. And we know it's interlayered areas of salt and shale because of what those deposits are. And they were storing gas some years ago, the local company was, and then there was a major eruption in the middle of the lake. This is right next to a lake, and the salinity of the lake changed, and the company that was storing gas in there quit storing it in, and the new company is saying, oh, well, there's no proof that was directly related. But anyway, so we don't need any more gas storage here. We do not need to be exporting natural gas to the rest of the world, which will only increase the price of natural gas in this country. And if you consider energy a security issue, it reduces our security. But I think there's even a bigger issue, which is that we know that to survive as a species, we cannot burn all the natural gas, all the oil that's in the ground, all the fossil fuels in the ground. We have to leave most of what's there in the ground in order for us to survive. So we are in this big struggle to try to stop these pipelines and this gas storage. And, of course, we're also in the middle. It's sort of interesting because we're in the middle of a major culture change because literally for generations, the whole political structure, the politicians, the regulations, the courts, all of them have all been saying, oh, but of course the gas and oil companies are working for the public interest in putting in pipelines and drilling wells and storage areas and so on. And now what we have to do is help all that structure, the politicians, the regulators, the courts, we have to get them all to understand that, no, this is no longer in the public interest. The public interest is served by leaving that stuff in the ground and not. I mean, I forgot, for these pipelines, they want to cut down a million and some odd trees, hundreds of acres of ponds and streams and rivers are going to go through. And they say, oh, well, it's going to be no problem. But you and I know it always is a problem.
Well, it's rape, pillage, and plunder, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, it's crazy. I think what you really want to see happen is enlightenment, because when people are enlightened and they're really connected to the Creator, they don't do stuff like this. They know better. They don't hurt or harm, and they know they're not going to destroy the earth.
Yes, that's correct. And we are at this sort of critical period where we're having to change what we do. And, you know, they talk about natural gas as a bridge fuel. Well, if it is, it's a bridge from nowhere to nowhere because, first of all, it doesn't get us anywhere. Second of all, we don't need the gas. We can very easily shift. If we spent the money we're spending on these pipelines, we could shift from fossil fuel to renewable fuel. There was a study done, the Jacobson study done in New York, that says by, I think, 2025, New York could completely switch over to renewable fuel. It's not like we don't have the technology. We do have the technology. We can do it.
People need the will to do it, and that's, you know, the people that are elected. If they're not going to do it, it ain't going to happen.
Yes, people need the will, and I would say it isn't the elected officials who need the will. It is us, the citizens, who need to no longer abdicate our responsibilities as citizens, but to demand that our politicians and our government serve our needs, not the corporations' needs. And say, look, we need to shift. This is ridiculous. We just need to shift over. You know, people talk about the problem. You know, what a burden it would be to do that. There's an illustration of some of the simple things that can be done to save significant number amount of fuel, of energy. There's a lot of our appliances use phantom power. That's power which is used by the appliance even when we aren't using the appliance. So, for example, your cell phone charger. The charger, even if your cell phone isn't plugged into it, when it's on, when that charger is plugged into the outlet, it uses a little bit of power. Or a lot of the TVs, for example, use power all the time just to keep them so that when you hit the switch, they'll go on immediately. And if we were to eliminate all the phantom power, I think something like 30, it would eliminate 30 power plants across the country.
Wow.
By power, which you don't see, you don't use, you wouldn't even notice if it was gone. So there's a lot we could say just by caring.
Well, you have to be an enlightened person to be able to do that. You know, really. You know, if you're not, it's just not going to happen. And you know, that's why I work so hard to helping, you know, as many people as you can, as I can, you know, pop into that enlightenment stage. It's like the 100 monkey theory, and it's the snowball. You know, the more you awaken, the more it'll happen. So, but, you know, if, in order for this to happen, we're talking of major enlightenment.
Yes, we're talking of major enlightenment, but I have to, but I also have to say that without that major change, we are in deep trouble. We are probably going to all wind up. Our species is going to wind up dying.
I agree.
We have to get out there and do it. And for us to not become enlightened is willful blindness. The data is there. We can tell it's there. It's not complicated. And we've been burning both ends of the candle for too long, and we need to just, as you say, people need to get enlightened. And one of the things that's wonderful about that process is that as people get enlightened, then more other people will. And it can snowball. It can snowball the other direction also, the direction towards enlightenment, towards reasonableness, towards walking softly on the earth that we live in, towards our species surviving, towards us not destroying the world around us. And, you know, we have, you know, well, let's talk about this. The other thing that we forgot about, I mean, in my gym, when I was young, we knew this one, and that was nuclear weapons. We were faced with the idea that, oh, my God, we might die in a nuclear attack. I can remember that. I remember that well. We've sort of forgotten about that. We had the MAD, Mutually Assured Destruction, and then we signed the Non-Proliferation Treaty, which was really actually very clever, because what it said was, A, you can't build any more weapons, and B, you can't test the ones you have. And part of the theory behind that was that if people couldn't test them, then it'd become more and more unreliable, and eventually they would... people would be afraid to even use them. But then they just step back. I recently heard that if Pakistan and India, who are, you know, tiny nuclear powers, if they had an exchange of weapons, the northern part of the U.S., would not have a month without a frost for 3 years. Well, that would be devastating. That's a tiny nuclear exchange, and that would be devastating. And that's nothing like what one of our Trident submarines could do, for example, if it had an accident. And we had this terrible situation where we had a nuclear weapon missile that was flown from Alaska down to Louisiana somewhere. It was all armed. It was alive. Nobody knew where it was for a long time until they just found it on the runway. We didn't even know where it was. And we'd had some of them dropped in this country by accident. But fortunately, it didn't go off. But we have this huge risk of these nuclear weapons, which we have not done what we were required to do, which is to get rid of them. And if, I just want to step back and talk about the madness of the whole nuclear weapons thing. When they had the Trinity test, that was the first A-bomb that we tried, that the first time we tried it. When they had that test, the scientists were pretty sure that it would not create a chain reaction of nuclear consumption that would consume the entire world. But they still pulled the trigger, even though they didn't think it would do that. And then we went on to the craziness of the bombing of Nagasaki and Hiroshima. We had a huge firebombing program in Japan. We firebombed every city in Japan except for four. From the beginning of the war, it turns out, they saved four cities, Nagasaki, Hiroshima, and two alternate targets. So they saved them for the A-bomb and then dropped the A-bomb on them. I mean, it was just madness, crazy. And there are people who say, oh, well, it really saved lives because it would have cost so much to attack the island of Japan. That's a story that was developed well after the war. I can't remember the guy who developed it because they were getting ecstatic.
Now, what's really scary to me, Elliot, is that I'm under the impression that you're not supposed to be around an area where there's been a nuclear bomb, right? Am I wrong?
Where there's been a nuclear explosion, absolutely correct.
They just rebuilt the cities, didn't they? So all those people are living under that high radiation constantly, and now you add to it what's going on from Fukushima and the high radiation over there.
And you know, Kathy, the other thing we have is we had this major fallout across the U.S., in the lower 48, because of all of our bombs. And we radiated our own population with all the bombs the military sent off in New Mexico and stuff.
I know, it's really, really sad. Well, now we've got to go from that to jump to talking about your trip and what you experienced in Palestine.
Sure. Let me say one last thing about the nuclear weapons, and that is that within all this madness in the history of nuclear weapons, right now we have about a $1 trillion program. We are rebuilding, we are building new nuclear reactors down at Oak Ridge so that we can start to build a whole new generation of nuclear weapons, which will start a whole new arms race and will put us, I mean, we never really got off the brink of extermination by nuclear weapons, but it will push us further to the brink of it.
Oh, I have to add one more thing to it. Do you realize that they're also shipping nuclear waste cross-country and they don't tell anybody? Now, you can be on the freeway and drive by this and get a dose of radiation and then get to wherever you're going and get sick and have no way of telling or understanding why you are sick.
And while we're talking about that, I mean, I know this isn't where we want to be, but still, we have every single reactor in this country is storing the waste radioactive fuel in on site, storing it right there. They talk about whether somebody wants to create a dirty bomb. There's a perfect source right there on every single one of our reactors. And if you think that they're secure, think about the Oak Ridge thing where Megan and the other two people went down to it's the Fort Knox of the atomic energy industry. And they cut through one fence and to their surprise, nobody showed up. And they cut through another fence and to their surprise, nobody showed up. and they cut through another fence, and nobody showed up, and they walked up to the vaults, and finally they had to get on their cell phone and call the officials and tell them they were there.
That's really sad.
It's appalling.
We
also have the issue that's happening in the things that are happening in Israel Palestine. And it's a sad situation. It's more than a sad situation. It's a terrible situation. It's really appalling. You never know quite where to start with it. We know.
Let's start with you work with the Meta Peace Team, and why were you there?
Yes, so we went with the Meta Peace Team, and Meta Peace Team does third party nonviolent intervention. And basically, we believe that conflict is normal, conflict is okay. The problem is we don't want violence in conflict. So it's fine if you and I disagree. That's normal. Oh yeah, that's all the time. But I don't need to throw a frying pan at you or call out the army. And we feel that third parties, other people, can help keep the violence out of somebody else's conflict. And that's what we were there doing, trying to help reduce the violence, because if you can reduce the violence of a conflict, then it is more likely to get less violent. As you reduce violence, it's more likely to get less violent. And we feel like this is a major component for creating peace in this world. If you can help everybody reduce the violence in their conflicts, that will make a big difference.
Well, what's
so
it
we
like?
There.
What's it
Go
like
ahead.
For the children there in West Bank?
That's a good question. Like everything in the West Bank, it's hard to fathom. It is perfectly conceivable that the Israeli army, if you were a Palestinian, will come to your door at 3 in the morning or 2 in the morning, bust down your door, come in and ransack your house looking for a 10-year-old child who they want to arrest. Because a settler said that child was throwing stones. That is literal. I mean, I'm not making that up. That happens.
You get arrested for stone throwing.
Well, Israel's now passed yes, that is correct. Israel has now passed a law saying you can get 35 years in jail for throwing stones. And little kids get arrested for it. Arrested for and thrown in jail, and maybe spend. And one of the problems is they can put anybody in jail for 3 months without charges, and they can extend that endlessly so that they may get arrested right or wrong, but they may never see a judge to find out whether they, we believe in the U.S., we believe in innocence until proven guilty. They may never see a judge, and that can happen to a young child, or not. I mean, I was on a road, the road between Nablus and Ramallah, and I was waiting for the service, which is a form of taxi, which is coming by, and there was a guy there, a Palestinian, who was up the side road. Oh, I don't know, several hundred feet. And a Palestinian who was with me said, oh, well, he's waiting for the taxi also. I said, well, what's he doing way up there? And they said, well, last week somebody standing here was run over by a supper car. This kind of violence against the Palestinians is daily. And these children grow up in it.
They're constantly in shock and trauma, everybody there in Palestine, what they're going through. They're constantly in a war zone, am I correct?
Yeah, I think it depends on what you call a war zone, yes. But I think that your point is correct, that they are constant. I mean, how can you have a war when one side has stones and the other side has machine guns? You know, it's not exactly a war, you know. But anyway, but you're right, is that the term we use often is PTSD, for post-traumatic stress disorder. But in the case of Palestine, it's not post. It is past, and it is present, and it is future, and it is ubiquitous, and it is part of their struggle in life. And we do know of all the physical things that PTSD does to your body. Not to mention the social problems, not to mention the psychological problems, but just plain the physical destruction it does to your body. And these children are growing up with it. I mean, when we make it a point to get children to, pregnant mothers in for health care, so we can, what we call wellness care, so that we can bear, so babies can be taken care of even before they're born, because we know it makes a big difference to the long-term outcome. And we try to get food in them when they're young, because we as a society know it's critical. And here is a whole group of people who, incidentally, with our tax dollars, is being attacked and traumatized continuously. And it has changed their whole culture. And, you know, another thing that we know happens, we saw this in particularly, it became apparent in Gaza, is that when men were arrested and put in Israeli prisons and tortured and brutalized and so forth and so on, when they came home, there was likely to be domestic violence. That's the consequence. So not only are we talking about the fear and trauma of never knowing when a vehicle comes by, whether it might attack them, never knowing whether somebody's going to come in and take your house, never knowing any of that stuff. There's also the issue of children growing up in a society that really can't take care of them. You know, I just did the calculations recently. The settlers who are on stolen land in the West Bank and are using stolen water used 14 times as much water per capita as the Palestinians who live there, because they aren't allowed access to water. The Palestinians average do not get the water that the UN says is necessary for healthy growth. So there are always many, many aspects that happen that are affecting the children.
You know, I wish, people, you can go to YouTube, and Elliot has some YouTube videos, and one of, you do a talk on Palestine, Israel, and you have visual, which I like the videos for, so you can actually, and you show, how much land the Palestinians have, and then how gradually over the years it's just been cut down and cut down and cut down. And I think I read in the paper maybe 4 or 5 days ago that Israel is going to let another 700,000 settlers in.
It may very easily be true. I mean, it's unbelievable. I mean, it isn't unbelievable. I mean, what we are seeing is we are watching ethnic cleansing as they remove the Palestinians from the land, make it impossible for them to live there. There are water is one of the tools. 70-some-odd% of the water from the West Bank is taken by Israel illegally. The water is one of the tools for forcing people out. Another is taking their land. So that I can't remember what the numbers are overall, but I can tell you this: in the West Bank, which is in theory the land that is Palestinian, is what remains of the Palestinians' land after they forced out In 1948, the Nakba, that alone, 720,000 people were made refugees. They were driven off of their land. 720,000, and then a whole bunch more were driven off in 1967 war. I forgot where I was going with this. But if you just take the West Bank, which is the only tiny piece remaining of the land that the Palestinians are allowed to stay on, which is supposed to be their land, 70%, well, it depends on how you calculate it, but between 60 and 70% of that land is occupied, controlled, and lived on by the Israelis. And this is what's left of the land that's supposed to be the Palestinians.
Now, one of the things that you did there was helping some of these Palestinians with their land, make sure they're able to get to their land safely and, you know, harvest.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, so that 60 to 70% is percent controlled by Israel. Includes many of the agricultural lands. Now those have had to be turned into olives because they can't irrigate, they aren't allowed to irrigate, and they can't get the water to irrigate because Israel is controlling the water, and they can't get to their fields on a regular basis, only when they get a permit, which is down there, likely to be like once or twice a year. So those are now olive fields. So we go over during the olive harvest because one of the other efforts that some of the settlers do is to deny the Palestinians, try to drive the Palestinians off from harvesting their olives because they know that if they can't harvest their olives, that's their livelihood and maybe they'll leave. Actually, there's two different versions of this, but we would go as internationals to go and be present, and it's the premise is basically the same as when you're dealing with police and the police are getting out of hand. Oftentimes, if they see a camera, if they know they're being filmed, if you're obvious about it, or even if you're, often try to film things with a cell phone that didn't work, but the cops didn't know it. But oftentimes they will start behaving better. So that's one of the purposes we do when we go with the Palestinians to harvest. And another simple part of it too is that they'll typically get 3 days to harvest. 10 days worth of work, 15 days worth of work.
And do they limit the people that are allowed to harvest?
It depends. Generally, they allow us internationals to go in to help. I have had times when they were saying, when they said, no, you weren't on this list, and they had the list of the people who were the farmers, and if I wasn't on that list of farmers, they weren't going to let me. In that particular situation, I was able to talk my way in, so we were all able to get, once I got in, we all got in. But it took a lot of things. It took the fact that I was an American. It took the fact that I was a veteran, so I could talk to the soldiers in a familiar voice so that they were, kind of make friends with them, to get them to allow us. And to get them not so much to allow us, but to get them to call their supervisors and their supervisors and their supervisors and further up the chain of command until eventually we got permission to do it. Like so much of that oppression, part of what's so hard to take is the fact that it is changing. There aren't clear-cut rules that everybody can abide by, and they even can know what is going to happen. So you may go to harvest today, and for some reason or other, there's some excuse why you can't do it today. You should have done it yesterday, and you have to do it 3 days from now, or whatever it is. Everything is nothing is easy to follow when there aren't any rules. that you can say, hey, wait a minute, you got to do it that way. But so it was important for me to be able to, as an international, not a Palestinian, a Palestinian couldn't have talked into it, to be able to be present in, so we could get up and help. But there's a whole other category of trying to help farmers get to their fields. When they built the wall, the apartheid wall, they didn't stay on the on what's called the Green Line or the 67 line or the 48 line, which is a line at the edge of what is internationally accepted as being the armistice line between the West Bank and Israel. They built that wall, cutting off hundreds of acres, well, probably more like thousands of acres, but in hundreds of acres chunks, cutting the between where the farmers live and where their fields are, so that they, in order to go to their fields to work every day, they have to go through the wall, and they have to go through a gate, and the gates are there's a time frame. They're supposed to be open seven thirty in the morning and 4 and 4:30 in the evening, and some of them were supposed to open at lunch. But the problem is that there's very little control. So the soldiers may show up early or late, but if they show up early, then they will let through all the Palestinians that are there, and they will, if there's nobody else there, they'll just close the gate. And that means that the people who show up at 7 when it's supposed to open won't get out. And there's no process or mechanism by which Palestinians can complain about this. So we would go to them, we would go to the gates and just and stay there and make sure that the Israeli soldiers knew we were there, and we were reporting to the UN when the gate opened and when the gates closed, to try to get them to do it at a way, because the poor farmers were having to show up, you know, at 5:30 in order to be there, just in case the soldiers show up early and open and close the gate early. But then they would sit there, and maybe the soldiers wouldn't show up till 9 or 10 o'clock. So they spend, you know, hours and hours and hours of their day just sitting there waiting for the gates to open. And another part of that process, and this is going from their house to their land. Nobody disputes this, their land. It's their land. But they just drew the wall. They just built the wall, cutting them off from their land. Another part of that process is that in order to go through, they have to go get inspected and checked out and so on and so on, which can take a long time. So, for example, one gate we were at, it would take hours for them to get through. They only had one set of people checking their papers. They could have had two. And after we started showing up regularly, they started having two people, two groups of people checking, so they could get them checked through twice as fast, which was, you know, it's hard enough to make a living, but when you're losing half your day at the gate, and then things happen. Like one time we were there, they started checking each person to see how much money they had. And if they had more than 50 shekels, they weren't allowed to cross. They had two choices. They could not go to work that day, or they could give the Israeli soldiers the extra money. But there is somewhere some rule that says they can't go with more than 50 shekels across the gate.
How much is 50 shekels?
It's damn little money. Let's see. It's funny. I should have been. I should be able to tell you this. So there was a time when I could have told you this very quickly. But the thing that's really important about it is that there is some kind of rule about that, but nobody's ever, but it's never been, it hadn't been used for like 6 months or a year, and nobody told them it was going to, so they, you know, they just happened to, they had whatever change they had in their pocket. They didn't think of having to take all the money out of their pocket before they went to work because they hadn't had to do it for a long time. All of a sudden, bingo, there it was. And that's part of this craziness of things. Which when it happens in all the aspects of your life, it must be it's almost incomprehensible. I know people say, "Well, how long is it going to take? How long does it take to get from here to there?" Well, it all depends on roadblocks. It may take you 15 minutes, or it may take you 4 hours, just depending on what they do. Or it might take you, it might be you can't even get through. Because they'll just all of a sudden, with no forewarning and no anything, they'll set up a roadblock, and at a given place or just sort of nowhere. So you wind up with this process that nobody really knows whether you can get somewhere or if you can get there, how long it'll take.
What did you find, you know, like when you had to go through these checkpoints, that you were delayed like that or you were, you know, allowed to go through faster? And was there any places in the West Bank that you were not allowed to go to?
So the question depends on whether I was using my international privilege or not. So when the road, there's the green plates and yellow plates, white plates and yellow plates. So the Israelis have a different color plate than the Palestinians. And when there's a checkpoint, everybody knows. Nobody has to tell them. Everybody knows the Palestinians all pull off the right. The Israelis all just drive on by. They pull the left and drive on by. Because everybody knows that that's the way it works. The Israelis can go through the checkpoint, but the Palestinians can't. So if I were to drive in a car with Israeli plates, I could get through. If I were to use I would do things like at checkpoints, I would walk to the checkpoint just to watch, stand there with a camera, watch. Now I could do that because I'm white. If I were a Palestinian, I couldn't have done that. They wouldn't let me do that. So part of my access or the speed of my access depended on whether I used my privilege my privilege as international as carrying an American passport because I could get away with a lot of things I couldn't otherwise. And could travel more easily, et cetera. Are things, for example, they would not let me near Tukaram and Faroon and both sides of that. There are three gates. There's actually four, but there's an agricultural gate, so I'll chalk that one off. There's a gate for trucks to go through. There's a gate for Palestinians to go through, and there's a gate for Israelis to go through. The Palestinians may not go through the gate that the Israelis go through. They have to have an Israeli license, plates, et cetera. But they also wouldn't let me, as an international, go through the big gate, which is for the Palestinian workers to go through. Just wouldn't let me do it. I wanted to see what the process was like. I wanted to see. I had heard, for example, that there are a number of checkpoints in there, places to check people out, and that typically they only have, you know, a quarter of them manned, and that's why it takes so long. But I couldn't get it, but they wouldn't let me in.
Wow. It is so sad.
It's just amazing. It's just unbelievable. And you know, in down in Hebron, there's like nobody quite knows, but there's like 400 or 500 settlers in H2, which is kill your legal structure. But anyway, and there's like about 4,000 or 5,000 soldiers, Israeli soldiers, who are down there to protect those few. It's just madness, and we would do things like escorting children to school. I mean, little children. I mean, you know, little 6-7-year-olds, 8-year-olds. You know, mothers would come out and hand us their children to carry to take to school, because if we weren't there, they got attacked. They didn't get attacked every time, but they did get attacked by adults. And it's unbelievable. And then the older kids, we'd watch the gates because this is still in Hebron or Alcalio. We would try to count the teachers and the students who went through the gates each day before they would shut the gate or before they would start tear gassing, so that nobody would go through it to get to school, because we were trying to create a record of what was happening in the board of the UN about when, you know, who was getting through.
Why would they show tear gassing the school?
Frankly, tear gas is lucky. When I was in Boreen, they shot kids on the soccer field. They didn't shoot many of them, but they did shoot them. And I think one of the things, Kathy, is really, really important for Americans to understand is this could not be happening if it were not for our government. It is our tax dollars that are involved in this. It is our politicians that are involved with this. It could, this kind of stuff, which none of us believe is right or reasonable. In fact, oftentimes the biggest obstacle I have with talking to people about this is they just plain don't believe it. They don't believe it's possible this could be happening. But it's really important for Americans to understand that this is happening because of our dollars, our complicity, our willingness to allow it to happen in our name. If you look at this, happens to be the era of elections and politics and politicking. If you look at almost every single, if you look at any of the presidential candidates, but if you look at your own senator or congressman's webpage, you will find some statement about, oh yes, I fully button back Israel. No matter what happens, we have their back. We'll cover them no matter what. There's something wrong with that. You wouldn't do that for your son. You would say, well, we're behind you. We always support you.
There is a verse in the Bible toward the end that says, whatever country supports Israel will always remain prosperous. And I think these Christians that are in power, I mean, you know, the ones that are in Senate and the Congress, believe that.
Yeah, there's whatever it is. I mean, I can give you some other explanations for it, but they are our representatives. They should be doing our work. I mean, they are doing our work, whether it's by our request or by our acquiescence. And we are therefore responsible for that work. And we have to understand that some horrible, horrible things are being done in our name, and that Palestinians are no saints, but they certainly are not a bunch of treaty terrorists, like they say, but like the stories try to make them out to be. They're people who are being pressed to the absolute wall, and they're being pressed to the wall with our tax dollars and with our work and with our complicity. because we are responsible for what our congressmen and senators are doing. That's just the reality. I mean, if you want to call it a democracy, or you want to think it's a democracy, or you want to create a democracy, however you see that, the only way that can happen is if we take responsibility for our congressmen and senators. And presidential candidates, and I don't even want to talk about the presidential candidates.
Well, that's good, because maybe we'll do that for another time. Because we done run out of time, you know, talking with you, it goes very, very fast, and I really appreciate you making effort to come on air tonight and speak about all of this.
Well, it's so important not to let these things go. I mean, so much bad things happen by our either looking the other way or else not making a point to try to see what is real and what is right and what is happening. It's very, you know, all these things are designed to make it easy for us to just ignore the terrible things. And I mean, another terrible thing we're faced with is the inequity of wealth. That's an important issue, a very, very important issue. I mean, I remind people, you can't grow cucumbers in the middle of the desert, because cucumbers take a lot of water. You just can't do that. And by the same token, you cannot grow a democracy when 90% of the assets belong to 1% of the people. You just plain cannot have a democracy with the inequity of wealth we have in this country, because they have so much power. And we've been through it before. We were through it. This is what happened during the period of the Rocker Barons. And we normalized wealth. We started saying, whoa, wait a minute, we're going to shut down the trusts, and we're going to have a progressive tax structure, so a real inheritance tax. And, you know, the average person sometimes gets angry and gets worried about inheritance tax, saying, I should be able to give it to my kids. But, you know, there's no reason. I mean, it would be appropriate for us to have an inheritance tax that didn't touch the first, say, $2 million you're giving away. That is the problem. It isn't the $2 million or $5 million that you have in your estate, which I guarantee you all never have, but it's the people who are making $120 million a year, for crying out loud. And that's a whole different ballpark. I didn't mean to get off on our but you know what's important? You know, I really want to bring this up because the role of people, us, driving our democracy is so important. And the conversation is happening in the election today, the rise of Bernie Sanders, the rise of Trump. The both of whom represent a very dissatisfied part of our population. A lot of that came out of Occupy, because it was the Occupy movement. You know, when I say 1%, right now when I say that, people immediately think they don't think you're talking about the amount of nitrogen in the air or something. They immediately recognize you're talking about the concentration of wealth, the hyper concentration of wealth that we have. So it is the people's movement which has begun to bring up this discussion about the inequity and how unfair our system is.
Well, I'm very excited when you talk about the people's movement, that people finally in Michigan are really going after Governor Snyder for what he's done. You know, recalls and you know, finally, I'm very excited over that.
It's really exciting. It's exciting to watch this beginning to, the people beginning to come awake once again. It goes forward and backward, but it's an exciting time to be involved. It's exciting to watch people begin to take responsibility. That's what's part of what's been exciting for me about this whole struggle with hydrofracking and the natural gas campaign, is because lots of people who up until they saw what was happening. I mean, you know, what's happening here is unbelievable. They're taking people's land by eminent domain, not for the public good, but rather for the profit of the corporations. Then they come in and they start stripping the trees, cutting down the trees on their land before they have a permit to build the pipeline, before they've ever paid the person whose land they've taken by eminent domain, but they haven't settled that thing up. And we just had a young man who was objecting, who was monitoring the cutting of the trees. He was, and they arrested him. I'm not quite sure on what grounds, but they arrested him and threw him in jail, and then put a $200,000 bond on him. And it was another guy out of jail. He was supposed to come up with $200,000. Now, I mean, the sequence of illegalities is just amazing and wrongnesses. But just taking the bond. Bonds are, by definition of the law, for one purpose and one purpose only, and that is to assure that somebody comes back in court. $200,000 for somebody who's picked up for, I don't know what, he was a misdemeanor, is ridiculous. That was not...
It's what really you don't call... He's not an honest judge. I mean, come on. I mean, they're in bed together. It's a very big bed.
That's right. You're absolutely right. It's not an honest judge. We had this, another situation, very similar, a similar situation where they were cutting trees on a right of way that they had taken by eminent domain, but they still hadn't paid the person, and they did not have a permit to build the pipeline yet, and the judge ruled that they couldn't block the cutting of the trees, and not only that, but they couldn't be within 150 feet of the pipeline, so they took another 300 feet of the person's land without paying them or anything.
Well, Elliot, we've got to wrap it up. We're over. We ran out of time. So you're going to have to come back on again, absolutely. Thank you for coming on, and thank you, everybody, for listening, and have a lovely weekend. Aloha.
Aloha. Thanks. Thank you.
Welcome to the Mind Cemetery, where the paranoia about the paranormal comes to rest every Monday at 9 p.m. Eastern, right here exclusively on the UFO Paranormal Radio Network. Heard around the world online at uprntalkradio.com, on FM 107.7 New Orleans, as well as 105.9 in Pass Christian, Mississippi. As always, we will do our best to delve into the unexplained, weird, and sometimes creepy topics you won't hear in your local news. Like what you hear on the show? Then like the Mind Cemetery Facebook page and follow at Mind Cemetery on Twitter. If you want to check out the show on your time, download the Mind Cemetery off iTunes and at soundcloud.com/UPRN for all of the UFO Paranormal Radio Network shows. Visit MindCemetery.net for info on upcoming guests, weird news, award-winning blogs, show archives, and of course, the ever-present UFO Stalker. Join the discussion live in the UFO Paranormal Radio Network chat room on Pal Talk or call into the show at 1-504-273-7379. What's coming through is a lie. What's holding up is a mirror. But what's singing songs is a snake looking to turn this piss to wine. Welcome back, everybody, to the Mind Cemetery right here on UPRNTalkRadio.com, Live365, Ustream, and on Twitter at Mind Cemetery and Facebook. I'm now using an app called Periscope on Twitter. If you do some tweeting, or if you had hopes and dreams of tweeting someday,
go ahead and follow at Mind Cemetery, and you can see when I crank up the Periscope for the shows, which is basically a live feed showing me talk, say words into a microphone. You also get to chat there and tell me stuff and ask me questions and tell me I'm good, basically. But welcome. I know it had been a very long layoff there for a while that we had. Nice little break. I mainly blame Joe because he almost died. That's the main reason. The other reason is sometimes, as you know, doing this show,